Welcome to our Wednesday Business Enterprise Talks podcast. I'm Dr. Shai Vivekanam, Director of the Bettany Center for Entrepreneurship here at Cranfield School of Management. We're live today from the School of Management on our Cranfield University campus in Bedfordshire. Joining us today is Nick Jenkins, founder of Moonpig, the well-known personalized card and gifting company. Nick will take us through his entrepreneurial journey and the challenges he faced whilst creating and growing his business, and through his experiences as an investor on Dragon's Den and in his own private capacity.
Well, first of all, thanks very much for inviting me along. It's always good to come back to the scene of the crime, where I first thought the idea of moving. But the entrepreneurial story started a bit earlier than that, when I was at university doing my undergraduate degree, which was Russian. I had started a business doing making dress shirts, you know, for formal occasions, you know, these dress shirts. And there was a time, this is going back to, when was this? 1986, I think, 87. And people would have these sort of dress shirts with very formal on the front, with underneath the denim jacket, with these sort of brightly coloured patterned sleeves and bodies. And I went one stage further and did screen printed designs of Tintin, Dennis the Menace, and Lenin, I think. Lenin, obviously, a nod to the Russian course. But they went down really well with students, and they were beautifully made, and I got them made up in Cyprus, and students wanted more and more of them. But I made a fundamental error very early on. When I ordered the first batch of shirts from the guy in Cyprus, he said, "What neck sizes do you want?" And I hadn't really thought about that, and I hadn't really asked anybody about that. And so I said, "I don't know, some 15s, 16s, 17s, 14s, maybe some size 13-inch neck." I mean, no size 13-inch neck is about like that. So I ended up with boxes of these things, which were beautifully made and would have suited a pygmy that likes formal dressing. But I couldn't sell them, so I lost a few thousand pounds on that. And I better knuckle down, and I will finish my degree and go and work somebody and earn some money back. And that's what I did, and I went off to Russia. And I was very lucky, and luck is one of the themes of this story, very lucky that at the time I did Russian, and I only did Russian by accident because I didn't get very good exam results, and I was going to do law, but I couldn't do law, and Russian was really easy to get onto. So I did Russian for that reason. But so having done Russian, the Soviet Union was started to collapse. So as I was doing it, this was 1986 to 1990, The Berlin Wall had collapsed and the Soviet Union was beginning to crumble. So I arrived there, about a year after I arrived there. Suddenly I was driving down the street one day, column of tanks drove past, and I thought, that does not happen every day. And then I went down towards the centre by the Kremlin, and the whole lot was being barricaded off. And that was the first coup. And the Soviet Union was overthrown, and suddenly it went very, very capitalist. So I've been hired to do a job, simply because I spoke Russian, that was quite simple, and then suddenly this opportunity cropped up, and no one really knew what they were doing. In chaos, even an ignorant man can survive. So I took advantage of the situation and created for my employer, I created a local Russian subsidiary. I mean, bear in mind that when the Soviet Union collapsed, there wasn't even such a thing as a limited liability company. They didn't even have that structure. The only structure of private enterprise they had at the time was a cooperative where you were only allowed to employ members of your immediate family. And that was it. And it was limited in size. So in the space and time that I was there, they had to create limited liability companies, they had to create banks, they had to create insurance companies, and all of this kicked off while I was there. So needless to say, it was all a bit chaotic, but it kind of played to the fact that I didn't really know what I was doing, but then no one else did either. So we kind of winged it for quite a few years and created a local trading company where we were bringing cargoes of sugar. I was a commodity working for Glencore, the commodity trading company, bringing cargoes of sugar in from Brazil and Cuba, refining them in Ukrainian sugar factories and then selling it into Russia. Had a storming business for a while. And then anyway, about 8 years later, it was all going quite well. But meanwhile, lots of the Russians are pretty smart people. They were learning very, very quickly and taking over. And then one of them tried to kill me. And so, it's probably time to leave. I can take a hint. So I left and came back to England. And thought, what am I going to do now? And I didn't. I thought about it. Tried to think of a number of business plans, and I frankly couldn't think of anything particularly sensible. So I thought I'll do an MBA while I'm waiting. And I chose Cranfield largely because you didn't have to do GMAT. I just simply couldn't be asked to do GMAT. And it wasn't that far. It wasn't that far from London, but it wasn't so close to London that I get distracted in the evenings by being out partying. So I chose Cranfield. Well, in fact, it was the only one on the list. So I thought, if I get into Cranfield, I'll go. And if I don't, I'll do something else. So and I thought, I'll use the opportunity for a year to work out what kind of a business to set up. And I have to say, it was a really useful course to do because it sort of gave me just about enough to bluff in every subject. I mean, not enough knowledge for me to do any damage with it, you know, but just about enough to realise that most business is basically common sense dressed up in a lot of jargon. And, you know, being a linguist, it's like learning another language, picked it up fairly easily. And now, honestly, I can bullshit on marketing terminology with the rest of them. But underneath that, what I realise is essentially it's all basically common sense. I mean, strategy in particular, actually. No one who runs a strategy department here. But I mean, strategy is one of those things where if you take a large strategy book and then pracing that down into sort of to 100 pages and then take the pages down to pacing that down to 10 pages, and you can pacing the 10 pages down to about one page, and then you're sort of left with a sentence, which is don't do stuff you don't really understand. But at the end of this process, it was very useful. It was an opportunity to bounce ideas off lots of other bright people. And that, I think, is one of the great things about the course, is that it really taught you that it is actually quite straightforward. It also gave me enough in every subject area to not be frightened. And I've noticed this in as I've come across lots of other entrepreneurs. People have this blind spot that they think, and they say, well, you know, can I see your management account? Oh, I don't do the management account. My accountant does the management account. I only want to see the management accounts, you know, or my accountant does that. And they have these blind spots they don't want to touch. Or they feel that marketing people have some sort of magical powers that normal people don't have. And actually what it taught me is, and normally in many jobs, in my previous job as a commodity trader, I haven't really been exposed to marketing. Sugar is basically a commodity, so there's no real marketing involved there. And we had very good lawyers, very good accountants. We didn't really get exposed to many things, whereas when you start your own business, you have to do everything. So the MBA was great preparation for that. And a wonderful opportunity also to prepare a business plan. Largely because there was a course for which you got points for preparing a business plan. And I created mine, and I called it splat.com. And it was all about a personalised greeting card business. So as soon as I left the course and got my rather mediocre MBA, I did get a bit distracted towards the end. But I had this business plan, and I thought, I'll do it. And I'd come up with about four or five different business ideas while I was here. One of them was growing sort of exotic mushrooms and selling soup. Not those kind, you know, truffles and stuff. And selling those to supermarkets. And then I realised during the course of the... Somebody else on the course had worked for a supermarket and said, you will be screwed over. Supermarkets will just screw your margins down to a barely acceptable level. And that looked like hard work. Then I thought about setting up corporate gyms so that people could basically train very close to work. What I learned after doing a little bit of more market research was that nobody really wants to sweat next to their co-workers. So that just wasn't going to work either. And I worked through a couple of others. And I came up with this the thing about personalised. Now, so does everyone know what Moonpig does?
Yes.
Right, good. Okay, so that saves an explanation. So when I came up with the idea, I'll do something on this internet, because the internet thing had just about started. I mean, bearing in mind, you know, this was 1998, 99, and I had only used the internet for the first time 6 months before that, right? So this was very, very new stuff. And in fact, I only got my email address. Actually, I say I got my first email address. My company, Glencore, had given me an email address 7 years before, and about 6.5 years after that, an email popped into my inbox from someone outside the company. I thought, how did anyone break into our company's communication system? I had no idea, having had it for 6 years, that you could actually communicate with other people outside. And that's because nobody had an email address for a very long time. We were very much ahead of the game. But so this was just at the beginning of the whole internet thing. And this was also at a time, and I can see some of you are just about old enough to remember, how painfully slow the internet was way back in 1998. Pages would take 5 minutes to load. Horrible. But I thought, you know what? I don't want to be a commodity trader anymore, and so I'm going to have to do something I really don't know anything about. So I'd better pick something that absolutely nobody else knows anything about either, and nobody knew anything about the internet. And then I started thinking about the model. And there's one lesson to be learned from this. It's really, really important. There's a couple of things you need to get right at the very beginning. The first thing, actually, is as all the entrepreneurs came in to talk about their experience on the ES1 course, one question I would always ask them is, well, what was it like about setting it? Did you want to set up with someone else, or did you want to set up your business on your own? And the conclusion I reached after the year was that a lot of us will have an idea, and you go to the pub with your mates. A few pints later, someone says, this really fantastic idea. Like, yeah, why don't we all do it together? And then you divide your company between three of you with 33% each. Now, one of you actually had the idea, and one of you will do all the hard work, and the other two have basically taken away 66% of your equity on day one. and then you've got to fall out with them, so you won't be friends anymore after all. So what I realized is that it's probably a really good idea just to start it by myself at the beginning. Keep 100% of the equity. That's one useful lesson I learned. The other thing I thought I could realise is the importance of a decent model. And I see this now as an investor, that I want to, if you're going to come up with a business idea, think it through and think, first of all, does anybody actually want the thing I'm producing? Okay, you think that's an obvious question? But it's amazing how much stuff people try and fog that people don't really want. Can I make any money out of it? That's another really important one. I mean, after all, there are lots of things that people want, like Twitter, that nobody wants to pay for it. And then the other thing is it big enough? Is it a big enough opportunity? And why am I the right person to make it work? Those are the things. And if you get that model right at the beginning, it's a lot easier than starting off with a bad model and spending the rest of your life trying to make it work. So I worked through this and thought, what are the ways in which I could make money on the internet? One of them is selling advertising space. At the time, back in 1999, 2000, nobody was buying much space on the internet. And of course, you had to spend a lot of money to attract people to it. So that was going to be fairly problematic. So I'd probably spend more money advertising to get people on than the value of the advertising I could spend. And some people subsequently, of course, realized that if you have really, really engaging content or user-generated content, that it can, if it goes viral, then you've got the opportunity to sell that advertising space. And the virality of the content is what attracts people to it, as Facebook discovered and so on. But then the other thing I thought, okay, well, if I was selling things like a digital camera, I figured that somebody at some point would work out an algorithm that would compare the price of my camera with the price of someone else's camera, and it would be exactly the same camera. So when you're on the internet and you don't have to bother walking from one shop to another, you just end up buying the cheapest one, and therefore your margins are just going to be squeezed. The other problem is with things like with selling physical things, is you have to buy them and put them in a warehouse and store them, and that takes up quite a lot of capital. So I thought, but on the other hand, for some reason, someone back in 1998 decided that anything that could be downloaded on the internet ought to be free. I don't know why we got into this mindset that stuff that can be downloaded should be free, but we did, and it's very, very hard to make money out of giving stuff away for free. Even I knew that, and I wasn't paying that much attention in the first 6 months, but I knew that. giving stuff away for free is not a good business model. So I needed a physical product, but I needed to make it sufficiently different from the product in the street to justify a higher price. And I thought, if I could personalize something in a way that would be very, very difficult to personalize something in a shop, in a physical environment, that might be a head start. My first idea was personalized CDs. For all of those of you who subscribe to Spotify, you'll realize why that would have been a really crap idea. The idea, people would, they'd down, put all the right tracks on it, and you'd send them the CD in the post. That would have been redundant very quickly. And then I thought about, I'd often bought greeting cards and tip-exed out the caption and written something much funnier and far ruder. And that seemed to be popular. Now, this I understand is a uniquely English thing, or British thing, and I appreciate that this is an international audience, but British people like to be rude to each other. We find it funny, and we don't take offence. What I'll do is I'll set up a greeting card company, and I'll use the combination of the internet to make it possible to personalise a single greeting birthday card. And the great thing was, it was the merging of two technologies. Digital printing was making it possible to print a single sheet of paper, whereas previously it would have required putting a plate in there and it would have been very, very expensive. If you tried to make a single personalised greeting card 10 years earlier, it would have cost £300. And this merging of the combination of the internet and digital printing made it possible to do this for £3, or to charge £3. So it actually cost pennies to make. So I thought, okay, fair enough. That's what I will do. And I started this business. Literally a week after I graduated from left Cranfield, and I went and found somewhere to work. And I found someone who knew something about printing. My main problem was I didn't know anything about printing. Or writing a website, or greeting cards, actually. Although sometimes complete ignorance of something can be quite helpful because you see things in a different way. The other thing is, you don't know what's going to go wrong. And the problem is, by the time it's gone wrong, you're already kind of in there and you've invested all your money, so you're going to somehow fix it. But if you speak to anyone who's been in the industry for a long time, it'll never work. Because they know why all the problems. Anyway, that was the idea. And I'd called it Splat.com in my business plan, but then I realised, as I tried to set it up, Splat.com was taken. As were 99.999% of all usable domain names. If there was one problem with the creation of the internet, it was that domain names were made ridiculously cheap from the very beginning. And so Canadian teenagers would buy them all up in the hope of selling them for millions. And actually what would happen is that they'd just get locked away forever and ever and ever. It made it very hard to find a suitable name. And I spent if I want to have a business which is going to go viral, how do I create a name that's going to spread? I thought, first thing is, it needs to be easily found on a search engine. And search engines were very, very embryonic at that time, but they did have a few things on them. So every name I looked at, first of all, it had to be available to buy, because in those days it was very difficult to buy domain names from strange teenagers in Canada. Nowadays there are systems for this, and escrow accounts and so on, but in those days there weren't. So I thought, it's got to be available, I've got to be able to buy it straight away. And secondly, it's got to be as short as possible, as few syllables as possible, and it's got to be phonetic, easy to spell, easy to remember. It's got to be easily represented in a graphic, in a logo. And the other thing, it doesn't have to have anything to do with the subject matter. If I just said greetingcards.com, that'd be great, so that everybody entering greeting cards into Google would come straight to our website. And it's bland. It would mean nothing. So I entered loads and loads of different things into the network solutions. For about 4 days, sat there putting together yellow, dog, blue, carrot. All these things had gone. And then I put in the word Moonpig, and it had been a nickname of mine at school. Not a great nickname, but anyway, the nickname. And it was available. It was available, and it was unique on Google. I put it in, and it didn't exist anywhere else. And I had thought previously that Moonpig had been a character from a cartoon show that someone had seen, but no, it was an utterly unique word. And then I don't really want to have a business named after my nickname at school. Couldn't find anything else for another 2 days, so I went back to it, and I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll draw a picture of a moon and a picture of a pig. Moonpig.com. It's pretty hard to misspell Moonpig. The importance of that lesson was brought home when we had a competitor called FunkyPigeon.com. And their PR company misspelled the word pigeon in their own press release. And you think, okay. That's the importance of it being phonetic and easy to spell. So that was the idea of the name. And the idea of the principle is, what I realised about these greeting cards is that what we want when we're buying a greeting is we want something to be relevant. We want something, you can try to touch a chord with someone that you know. And so the ability to put their name in on its own, happy birthday John, fine, but we know how digital printing works, there's nothing special about that. It was about finding really, really funny cartoons and somehow sort of weaving them into the story. Or creating a spoof magazine front cover and uploading their photographs and, again, weaving them into the story somehow. It was about relevance, and it was about being, about making a closer connection with someone. And that's the reason why people don't throw them away. And we knew we had a winner from the very beginning. We got the thing going. Oh, the other thing is, by the way, that those of you who remember the dot-com boom, the first lesson of, in the dot-com boom was raise some money and then spend it all on a big launch party. And then worry about how to raise more money afterwards. And I had this launch party in a thing called the Fulham E-Bar, which was sort of a bar which had lined with computer screens. Yeah, that concept doesn't exist either anymore. But so we turned up at this place and had all these computer screens with the website there and free drinks and canapes. And the traffic was so bad that all the journalists didn't come, but all our friends came and they ate and they drank and they played on the website. And then the website crashed completely and lost all of the details of everything that had been recorded throughout the entire party. And we had to start all over again. That was another important lesson. Don't spend all of the money that you've raised on the launch party. You might need some more to go rebuild the website. Another lesson I learned there, by the way, is if you're going to set up a technology business, you need to have one person in your company who really understands technology. Because it's a bit like dealing with a plumber or a builder at home. And you say, how much would it cost to put in a new heating system? Complicated, it's an old building, you know, and then you want to change it. Oh, no, it's very, and you have no idea how much it costs. I mean, how much a bit of, you know, the piping costs and so on. It is so much worse with developing a website, particularly in 1999, 2000, when nobody knew what they were doing. And we had wild quotes from sort of £500,000, which I know sounds ridiculous now, because we all know we can make this stuff up for much less, ranging from about £50,000 to £500,000. Eventually, I spent £70,000 building the first version of the website with an agency, of which clearly then broke. And I had to find someone to come in to help me liaise with these people and at least have someone who spoke their language to work out whether or not I'm ripped off. So I found someone who had a very good track record of IT and hired him. And he went away, but he said, I've never built a website. But I'll buy a book about it, and I'll come back on Monday. He came back and said, I reckon I could rebuild this. And he said, just give me 2 weeks. 2 weeks later, he came back, he had rebuilt the entire website. I mean, I've been very fortunate, again, the theme of luck, I've been very fortunate to find someone who was a genius. This guy, by the way, had no formal qualifications to his name whatsoever. When I looked at his, because he came by recommendations, I never really saw his CV. When I looked at his CV afterwards, he very carefully said, studied for the following GCSEs. He never said he took them. Didn't have a single formal qualification to his name. But as a result, the great thing was that he'd never get a job with any normal company. So he had to kind of stick with us. But the guy was a genius. He got it up and running. What we realized, we had a winning concept, because the first card started to go out. And I remember the day when we got the website live and finally someone bought a card that wasn't related to anybody in the office. Right? And the credit card thing came in, so £3.34 from Mrs. Miggins of Perthshire. I mean, does anybody know Mrs. Miggins of Perthshire? No, we have a real live, genuine person who has spent £3.34 on our website. Yee-hee! Most awarding money I've ever earned, actually. You know, the idea that someone likes your ideas and they don't know you and they've decided to buy it. Anyway, needless to say, of course, the trickle of business was a little bit slow. And I realised very early on the big problem of an internet business is that it's like having a shop that has no front door or front window or anything. And if people don't know you're there, you're not going to get any business. And the problem with being online is letting people know that you're there. So it was kind of a little bit slow to start off with. But we kind of... The other element of luck, by the way, was that having had a good job in Russia, I'd made a bit of money, and I was able to put that at the beginning to get the thing going. It's very, very important to be able to prove, the more you can prove the concept before you ask for money, the better. So I'd got it to the point where I'd got the website going, and we were able to produce the first card, and we found the printing equipment to do this, and so we had something to show people when they were looking at investing. And investors loved it, and the customers loved it. The problem was there just weren't very many of them. We thought, right, okay, well, how do we spread the word about advertising? And we tried, every form of advertising we tried didn't really appear to work. What we did know is that the customers loved it when they got there. It was just costing us too much to bring them. And in the first year, we had a turnover of £90,000. And I'm reminded of this now, having done Dragon's Den, that if I had gone on Dragon's Den in my first year, And Peter Jones would have said, so what's your revenue? £90,000. What's your gross margin? £45,000. And how much did you make last year? Well, we lost £1.1 million. And what do you value your business at? £3 million. I would have been thrown out of the den completely. But what I appreciated was that I had an idea which was novel, I had an idea that was incredibly scalable, and I had a product that people wanted, and I was the first person to be doing it. And we had the ability to make that happen. And it was the scale of the opportunity meant it was a great... why I was able to raise money at £3 million. And interestingly enough, those people who, when I raised money at a valuation of £3 million, they made 40 times their money in the end. So that was justified. But the problem was how to get from sort of £90,000 of turnover up to the £2 million of turnover that we needed to break even. And there were several things going for us. We had a fantastic gross margin. So when you look at the business model, we had a great gross margin because basically we started with a piece of paper, a big pile of paper in the corner of the room, and a pile of envelopes, and a computer. When somebody orders a card, a card gets made, but it doesn't get made until someone orders it. So we didn't have any unsold stock whatsoever. Right? Our stock was about 0.5% of our turnover. So we had almost no capital tied up in stock whatsoever. That was a big plus point. Second plus point was the product was delivered through the letterbox by post, by Royal Mail. No couriers involved whatsoever. Royal Mail. I think at the time, 34p would take that card all the way to Scotland, and 50p would take it all the way to Buenos Aires. So it was very cheap to deliver, and we had nothing tied up in it. It was a unique product. Nobody else was offering this product. You couldn't compare this product with anybody else's. So we had a lot of things going for us, and we just didn't have very many customers. So when you don't have, we didn't have very much money either, because the other thing that had happened was that in the year 2000. Was when Boo.com collapsed. And Boo.com was this big sort of poster child for raising money. They raised £134 million for their clothing business. And then when they finally, that's before they launched, when they finally launched, they'd sold £36,000 worth of clothes before they went bust. So needless to say, venture capitalists after this point were not particularly interested in investing in consumer-facing websites. So I was a little bit stuck. So I had to sort of wind back my plans and find people who were prepared to fund this thing. So I managed to raise £1 million from a collection of angel investors, largely on the basis, look, here's a website, here's the product. Do you get the product? Yes, we like the product. Good. Okay. And that was it. We had to try and make it work. When you don't have very much money, the one good thing that you learn is how to make the most out of as little money as possible. So we wanted to test every single marketing channel we could and work out what the cost of customer acquisition was on each channel. And perhaps the one textbook that I did get off the shelf from my MBA course was a statistics textbook, which taught me how to work out the absolute minimum that I need to spend in order to get a statistically significant sample size. And we realised that by spending sort of a couple of £1,000s on each campaign, we could work out whether or not this cost of customer acquisition for that channel was worthwhile. Unfortunately, pretty much every cost of customer acquisition was way beyond the £10 that we thought we could afford to spend. So we kept on trying, and nothing was working. But the one thing that was working along the way was that customers were telling customers. So our customers were coming back, and our customers were telling our customers. So we knew that for every customer that we got, we would get another 0.3 of a customer. And we got really, really good at measuring exactly what was going on the website. Now, the great advantage of having a business that is a website or anything online is that you can measure absolutely everything and track everything. And what you want to do is to use that data and squeeze it to get every useful bit of information about how to run your business. So we understood and we could model very, very quickly because we didn't have many customers, but they were all very small customers. And I thought we could model what they were doing over time. So we knew that if we got 100 customers, we knew roughly how many of them would come back in month one, month two, month three, month four, and so on. We then knew how many people they would tell and how many of their friends would come on board. And we could model all this. So from this, we worked out that we could afford to spend £10 per customer to acquire a customer. Now, at this time, some of these things didn't exist. Social media clearly didn't exist at this point, but search and paid-for search had just been invented. So we tried paid-for search, and we got some really good results. We were getting £5 cost of customer acquisition. The problem was the number of Because nobody knew that personalised birthday cards existed, the number of people looking for personalised birthday cards was really limited to the people who already heard about us. So we were squeezing as much as we could out of that. We were getting 3,000 customers a month out of paid-for search. And it was only costing us £5 cost of customer acquisition, but we couldn't spend any more money. We also found with PR that we'd spent £30,000 a year on PR, but if we had spent £300,000 on PR, we wouldn't have got 10 times as much coverage. So the thing that we were looking for was not only something that was going to give us the right cost of customer acquisition, but something that would enable us to put our foot on the floor and go. Anyway, so we carried on like this for years. And the other thing that we were doing in the meantime, of course, was polishing the route through the website like a, you know, like a luge. So just to make sure as many people as possible who started that journey were going to end up in the credit card page. And that's the critical thing, working out why it is that people were getting stuck on different pages. Were they getting confused by the language and so on? Polishing and polishing and polishing this route through. So we focused on several things. One, get the product right. Well, we knew that our customers loved the product because we knew that people had bought once, those that bought once would come back again and again and again. So we knew we got that right. We knew that people who received cards were coming in and buying them. So we knew that we got the product right. And we polished the website all the way through. And we thought, and eventually by about 3 years in, this was after four rounds of fundraising. And I can tell you, when you're on your fourth round, your first business plan, by the way, is the most perfect of all, because it's totally untainted by reality. And your hockey stick graph is legitimate, because nothing has proved it wrong as yet. Your second one, when you have to go back to your first investors and say, yeah, okay, well, we slightly misjudged that, but we've moved the hockey stick graph that way, and okay, you can get away with that once. Believe me, by the time it's a fourth version of your website, and you're going back for more money, it's really, really hard, and there's a bit of a credibility gap. I was very lucky, actually, that I just spent all of my investors had refused to put more money in to prop this thing up. This is 4 years in, by the way. Sales were growing like this, and our overheads were coming down here, but there was still this enormous, great big gap. And most of our investors had actually lost faith by that point. But I did manage to meet someone at a party who was very drunk, and had just sold a bank, and he was in the mood to invest. And he was the last person who came in 2004. And that was that last £150,000 of EIS money was the bit that kind of nudged us. Because I believed, I was reading these numbers, and I knew that our customers loved it. I knew that that our customers would get more customers. And even if we couldn't find any cost-effective form of advertising, our customers eventually would multiply to the point that those lines would converge. And that is pretty much what happened. So we weathered it out for 4 or 5 years until eventually the lines of the gross margin contribution from our customers met up with our overheads, which by this point were considerably lower because everything that wasn't screwed down in the office had been thrown out the window and sold. And then we broke even. And then in 2006, the one thing I hadn't tried by this point was television. And for some reason, I thought television was a very expensive form of advertising. I don't know why I thought that, but I didn't think it would be appropriate for greeting cards. I'd never seen anyone advertise greeting cards on television. But we had a small competitor, which was then called Remind4You. Now, this is Remind4You.com. I go back to my earlier point about things that are easy to remember, and you don't have to explain them. Never put hyphens in the middle of a domain name, and don't use letters, numbers instead of letters. Anyway. So it was a dreadful name of a website, and it was a pretty dreadful website. But they advertised on television, and they spent 50,000 quid on this TV advert, on the media. And I was measuring what all of our competitors were doing. We had a few competitors, and every month I would buy a card from them and write down their order number in a spreadsheet, and which would then deduct it from last month's order and tell me how many orders they'd taken in the last month. So I did this for a little worksheet for every one of our competitors. And we didn't have many, but we had four or five. And these guys, I realised, were during the course of this month of advertising, had sold 5,000 cards, which is probably 5,000 customers. So we thought, that's probably £10 a customer. Well, blow me down. We must give this a go. So by this point, we'd just broken even. And in fact, we'd made £80,000 profit that year. This is 2006. And we spent all of that £80,000 on £30,000 advert, which is very cheap and cheesy, and £50,000 of TV media. And And then we came up, we also realised at the time that no one had really done a jingle for a while. You know all those jingles you remember from your childhood, you know, get smash, get smash, and finger of fudge, just all those things. I mean, they're just, like some mental worms. They go inside your head and they stay there forever and ever. But anyway, no one had done one of these for a while. So we thought we could probably get away with one of those. And we came up with the, not my idea, actually, the ad agency came up with the idea of moonpig.com. And it stuck. Amazing. So we came up with the ad and it worked. So we spent £50,000 and we got 5,000 customers. Fantastic. So we doubled it. And the money came back. The gross margin that came back from that was enough basically to pay for the advertising. So we doubled it to £100,000 and we got £9 cost of customer acquisition. Then we doubled it again the next month to £200,000 and then £400,000 and then £800,000 and then £1.2 million. And at £1.2 million spent per month, we started to get a little bit of a rise in the cost of customer acquisition. So we pulled it back down to £800,000 a month, and that year we spent nearly £10 million on TV advertising. And turned the business from a 2 million turnover business to a 45 million turnover business, making £80,000 in 1 year to making £15 million in a year, in 3 years. And we didn't spend any investment money on that whatsoever. And because, of course, the thing about investing in advertising is that if it works, you don't need to invest. It pays for itself. And which is why it always makes me laugh when people ask me as an investor, oh, well, we need to spend a huge amount of money on marketing, and our marketing will be very, very successful. So, well, if it's successful, then it should pay for itself, shouldn't it? but you need the money to experiment on advertising. But once you hit that thing, which is the right cost and it's scalable, and television is ultimately massively scalable, then you just keep on spending as much as you possibly can. I have an investment in a business recently, and I kind of took my eye off the ball because I was busy with other things. About 3 years later, I came back and it was kind of going all right. And I thought, well, how much are you spending on marketing? We spent £2,000 a month. Well, how do you decide what to spend? Why to spend £2,000 a month? So, well, because that's all we could afford. I said, well, but your cost of customer acquisition is much less than the gross margin you're making on every customer on their first order. So why wouldn't you just keep on spending and keep on spending until you're not making any more money? And we haven't thought of that. It's amazing how many people just think, we'll decide a marketing budget. Your marketing budget is decided by how much money you can manage to get out of the door at the right cost of customer acquisition. And if it's paying for itself, then you just keep on spending and keep on spending. Anyway, that is pretty much what we did. And that's what took us through to profitability. And we got through, by 2011, we had 5 million customers. And it was, we'd been number two in the profit track. I think we had an average profit growth of 134% compound for over 3 years. And I realised, you know, that's fantastic, or it's not going to last. And I love that part of the journey. Not so keen on that part of the journey, and really not keen on that part of the journey. So I think now is probably the time to sell. The other thing is that when you have a business where 99% of all of your assets are tied up in one company, which could go pear-shaped tomorrow, It's a vulnerable feeling to be in. I didn't mind at the beginning when I had no money and I'd spent all my money setting up Moonpig, and I thought, well, you know, I have nothing. If I return to nothing, no problem. But suddenly I had quite a lot. I thought, I don't want to go back to nothing. and so now is the time to sell. So I started a process of selling, and I made myself the executive chairman, which is the best role I've ever had in a company. It means you get to take all the best decisions and you don't have to do any of the work. So I hired a managing director who came in, and I explained to him, look, you're the managing director, you're not the CEO, because I'm executive chairman. So I get to make all the fun decisions. Right? But you get to run this thing, and if anything goes horribly wrong, you have to sort it out. And I remember on one occasion I said, in order to help you with this job, I'm going to go on holiday for 3 months. And I don't want to speak to you. And if it screws up, it's your fault. So I did that. And amazing, they came back and the company was healthier than it was before. And I do remember him once calling me on holiday and saying, we've had a denial of service attack. We're being attacked from all sides. I said, that's awful. Tell me when it's over. He's talking about it. There are lots of wonderful lessons that I learned along. And eventually then we did, so we got the business at this point, and there's a point at which everybody wants to buy you. And you sort of have to catch that moment, because then there's also a point shortly after that when nobody wants to buy you. And you see these people who, most people made their money by selling early. And so it's around about the right point. We sold to actually a much smaller company, but backed by American venture capital. We reversed the two companies into each other, and that's why it became PhotoBox. And I have to say, it was still the best decision I made. Partly because we were operating out of Guernsey because we had a VAT advantage of being in Guernsey, and the government removed that advantage 2 months after I sold the company, which we had in fact sort of. We both sides debated this and said it was highly unlikely to happen. Fortunately, they also thought it was highly unlikely to happen, but it did actually strip half the value off the company. So I was so relieved that I'd sold by that point. And the other great thing that came out of it is that PhotoBox did a really good job of looking after it, and the company is now turning over 65 million and making sort of 15, again, making 15 million a year profit. So they've done well, but not so well that I regretted the decision. I mean, you don't want to sell a company and then watch it sort of, you know, quadruple. No. But on the other hand, I don't want to sell. I don't want to bump into the person who gave me my millions, and he's on the street and he's thinking, oh, I wish I'd never bought the next company. So the best deals are deals that work for both sides. So it worked out very well. And after that, I went off. I thought, right, what do I do next? Because there's always this existential question of what do you do when you sell a business? You think, oh, you know, who am I now? If I am not Mr. Moonpig, who am I? And I went off and worked in the charity sector for a year. I ran a charity for a year. and then started doing a lot more angel investing. I'd started angel investing in my last couple of years at Moonpig because we were making quite a lot of money and taking it out as dividends. And so I started angel investing, which is really like a form of... It's a form of informed gambling, really. I mean, it's the same sort of thing. You know, it's not like putting money in the horses, but you feel as though you know that you ought to be able to have some sort of way of influencing the outcome. I've since learned that it is a bit random, and I've made 29 angel investments. But it's been fascinating being on the other side of the fence. Just wondering how I've been rabbiting off rages, haven't I? Because all the lessons that I now remember what it was like dealing with my investors. And realizing why some of them were really pissed off in the first 3 years when I said, oh, no, I know I said it was going to do this, but actually it's done that. And can I have some more money, please? But the lessons I learned from it are that, one, that you have to have a great product. You have to understand why people want to buy your product. You have to know that product is going to make you a decent margin. Because I see loads of things that people want to buy, but if you can't make enough margin out of it, you are really making a rod for your own back. And within that margin has to cover the cost of all of your customer acquisition, all of your marketing, and all of your overheads. So if there's not enough gross margin in there, you'll always be struggling. You have to really think through the business model before you start, not after you've started. Because if you think through the business model and it's not a very good one, you can stop at that point and not set up that business. But on the other hand, if you set up the business and worry about it later, you're stuck with it. The most important lesson I learned is about hiring people and looking after them. It's about hiring people and allowing them to get on with their jobs. Most small companies get limited because the owner thinks he or she is the only person that can make decisions. And you're limited then by the number of decisions that you can make in one day. And that's limited. It really is. And it restricts the size of your business. When you get to the point that you're comfortable enough to employ people who are brighter than you are, and you let them get on with their job, and you make sure they're happy, your company will grow. And then the other thing is making sure that they're happy, creating a decent working environment. You want to hire people for whom this is a great opportunity, not necessarily the best people, because you might find someone who is the best person for the job, who views your company as a stepping stone to the next big job. Or you might find someone who's pretty good at the job, who thinks your company is fantastic and will work his arse off to make it work. So it's about finding the best fit. And the other thing is giving people room to grow for 3 or 4 or 5 years. Because if you can keep people for 4 or 5 years, you get the best value out of them. If they stay for a year, the first 6 months they're useless, and if you only keep them for a year, then you've only had half the value out of that person. Keep them for 5 years, you've had 4 and a half years of valuable use out of that person. You can't expect to keep people forever. Having said that, my first employee from Moonpig has just left after 17 years. That was probably a bit too long. but of the original team, I think that I prided myself in the fact that nobody ever left to get a better job. And I was able to keep growing their roles and keep them interested and give them something more to do. And the other thing is making it a decent place to work. And some of that means listening to them, respecting their opinion, and allowing them to do their job properly. And they'll be happy. And what's interesting is I look at the company now that it's bought, and they do have problems with retention. They have problems hanging on to people. And they've lost some of the culture that we created, which I think we took for granted. The culture largely came from the fact that I spent a lot of my time in the office, and I wanted to be a nice place to work, and if I'm surrounded by happy people, it's going to make my life better. So I'd like the people around me to be fairly happy. Now, it doesn't mean to say you allow them to do whatever, you know, whatever they want to do, but at the same time, having the right culture in a company is great for business, it's great for retention, and ultimately it just leads to a better business. That was important. There were a few other things that I learned along the way. One was the importance of decent management accounts. Now, when I talk about learning enough to bluff, that financial accounting part of that course is really, really, really helpful. And I didn't learn much. Unfortunately, I wasn't paying that much attention when I was here to that particular course. But I hired someone who was really bad at accounting and totally screwed it up, and I had to sort it all out. And hiring a bad accountant is one of the best ways of, and having to unravel it is one of the best ways of learning how to do your accounts properly. So I learned a lot about managing accounting. But the one thing I did, and I also learned a lot from one of my investors who insisted on a much more detailed format of monthly management reporting, of not just the financials but the KPIs as well. And to me at first it was just a pain in the ass, because he'd expect these numbers and have to produce these numbers. And what I realized after a while was that I was finding the numbers really useful. And I now insist when I invest in a business that I don't want him to produce numbers for me. I want the management to produce numbers that are useful for them, that tell them how to run their business. But they have to know how valuable that is. And so setting them up in the first place with the right dashboard that tells them what's going on. You wouldn't drive a car if you didn't know how fast you were going, how much petrol you had in the tank. And yet it's amazing how many people run small businesses without having decent management accounts. So that was really important. I also realized you have to pay attention to the legal details. It's amazing how many people don't pay attention to the articles, think, oh, my lawyer will deal with that. But they're there for a reason. The Articles Association, when you set up a company, are there to basically preempt all the squabbles that you're going to have with your shareholders over time. And it won't matter at all until there's a problem. And when there's a problem, it's too late to do anything about it. And it's incredible how many companies I see now that are looking for investments who haven't really paid any attention to that, or they haven't signed the documents, or they've said, oh, well, we promised this or we promised that, but we never wrote it down. It's really important to have these things written down. And if ever you are doing deals where you do, he's my great mate, I did a deal on my handshake, write the thing down in an email, because 5 years later, you will have a very different recollection of that conversation, particularly if one of you was drunk. There are lots of those sort of things. But the other thing I did learn is the importance of luck in all of this, in that it's easy to say, I had a successful company and it was successful because of this. Sometimes you just catch a wave, right? And you're just in the right place at the right time and you catch a wave. And no amount of studying is ever going to replicate that. And it's very, very hard to replicate that again. It's really, really important, if you do catch a wave, to recognize that you caught a wave. Because otherwise what happens is you start thinking, everything I touch turns to gold. And it doesn't. I learned that in my first investment, when I invested in a pay-by-the-hour car business, which was a great concept, but if someone came to me looking for investment, and it was obvious to me this company was about to go bust. So I bought the business out of administration for 50,000 quid and set about turning it around. And I think I spent £900,000 on the business in the first year. So I'd spent a total of £1 million. And I sold it for £1.59. I don't know where the 59p came from. I sold it as a nominal sum, and somehow 59p in interest, so I got tacked onto the cheque that I got. But I kept that cheque as just to remind myself the fact that not everything I touch turns to gold. Some of it turns to lead, and that was one of them. And what happened was that I bought this company in August 2008, just before the financial crash, just about a week before the financial crash. In fact, the ink wasn't even dry as the world of finance just completely collapsed, and all the leasing that you would normally need to buy more cars completely disappeared. And so we were left in the position of we wanted to expand, and we had to buy cars for cash. And it was an impossible situation. That was just bad luck. Sometimes you have good luck, sometimes you have bad luck. But it's important to recognize that sometimes there's not much you can do about it, good or bad.